From the studios of Ave Maria Radio in Ann Arbor, this is Veterans Radio. And now, here's your host, Ken Rogge.
And good morning and welcome into Veterans Radio. I'm really excited about today's show. And I got some help in the studio here. Dale Thronberry's opposite me.
Good morning.
Good morning and welcome. And in a control room, we have in our intrepid Bob Gould.
Screaming Eagles, airborne. Hoo-ah!
Oh, there we go.
Sounds like he's falling out of an airplane instead of jumping out of one.
I think he did. we have a, we have a great show, and I'm really excited about it. We have one of America's most decorated officers on the show today, Colonel Bud Day, retired United States Air Force. Hoo-ah! And he holds every combat medal available from the Medal of Honor on down, which is an amazing accomplishment. He's the only officer to ever do that. So
he was in the service for a while too.
Well, he was. Yes, he was. But even still, it doesn't matter how long he was in. Just to have all those medals is amazing. Just a amazing feat.
Well, I'm looking forward to talking to him because it's going to be very interesting. He's got stories that we won't believe, and I know our listeners won't believe it.
I know. I read his biography. Wow, that's just awesome. And, of course, we have a special guest today, and he's going to be calling in about 10 minutes after 9. So, Dale, you've got some news stories for us.
We've got all kinds of things going on. As the sun comes out and the sun starts to shine and it gets warmer, we have a number of events going on in the local area, especially in the Ann Arbor area. We've got a local church sponsoring a Support Our Troops Sunday. That's next Sunday, May 20th, at the St. Luke Lutheran Church in Whitmore Lake. And they are encouraging all veterans and those on active duty are invited to attend. There's going to be a Boy Scout Honor Guard, a gathering of care packages for soldiers in Iraq, Afghanistan, and local veterans hospitals are going to be featured. The guest speaker is going to be one of our good friends, John Kinzinger, the past president of the Washtenaw County Vietnam Veterans of America, local, I'm a union guy, Chapter 310, and former Michigan Veteran of the Year in 2003-2004. For more information on that, call 734-426-4006, or you can visit www.livingwatermi.org. For more information on the St. Luke Lutheran Church Support Our Troops Sunday, next Sunday, May the 20th. Vietnam Veterans of America, Detroit Chapter 9, is hosting their annual Armed Forces Day picnic and chapter reunion on Saturday, May 19th. That's 12 noon. And where are they going to be? They're going to be...
That's on Woodward and...
right, by Veterans Park.
Yeah, Woodward and Temple.
Correct. For more information on that, you can give their chapter president, Dave Trevino, a call at 586-445-2206. So you listen to Veterans Radio next week, and then you can go to a picnic in downtown Detroit, which should be really fun. And then finally, Thunder Rolls in Belleville, Michigan, their third annual bike ride, motorcycle ride, is going to be on Memorial Day, Monday, May 28th, and it begins at 11 a.m. in downtown Belleville. And I think it looks like a great opportunity for all you bikers out there. And we are going to, for more information, you need to contact the Brown Family Center at 734-697-5090.
And the Baptist Church on Textile in Ypsilanti is also having a special service on Sunday the 20th at 11 o'clock to honor all veterans, police officers, firemen, and EMTs, I believe.
And at 11 a.m. We will attempt to put all these up on our website at veteransradio.net. Click on events, and hopefully I'll get those up there this afternoon for you. We need to get into some news, and a couple of big news items really are. Number one is that Congressman Phil Hara, a Democrat of Illinois and member of the House Committee on Veterans Affairs, has called on the VA Secretary Jim Nicholson to resign. Amid reports that he approved a number of bonuses for senior VA personnel shortly after their faulty accounting practices resulted in a $1 billion shortfall of the VA, it just never seems to go away.
Nope.
According to the Associated Press, the bonuses were awarded even after government investigators had determined that the VA repeatedly miscalculated, if not deliberately misled, taxpayers with questionable methods used to justify the Bush administration's cuts to health care amid a burgeoning Iraq war. Come on, guys. POW, here's a good thing, though. POW Benefits Act has been introduced by Gus Bilirakis, a Republican of Palm Harbor. I'm not sure what town or city or state that's from. But anyway, he has introduced the Prisoner of War Benefits Act, and what this will do is it establishes presumptions of disability compensation for several diseases, including type 2 diabetes and osteoporosis, for all former POWs to claim these disabilities as being service connected and will qualify them for disability compensation. Good time.
Very appropriate.
I think so.
Overdue.
I know. How am I doing on time?
You're doing fine.
Okay. Our favorite vehicle in the transportation department is the Humvee. Well, you know, doors, you know, we've upgraded these Humvees with armor and so on and
so forth.
Well,
right.
to protect
the troops.
Right. Well, now those doors are jamming shut as a result of an attack on an unintended consequence of our up armoring. Due to the jamming problem, records show that the Army must fix the doors of some 18,000 armored Humvees because they can't get the doors open when they're attacked. One quick fix has been to weld hooks on the sides of the Humvee door so that another truck can rip them off to get the troops out.
Oh, no.
Yes.
The Humvee was a good vehicle, a good utility vehicle, but I don't think it was ever intended to go into combat.
No, I don't think so. And the Army plans to spend an additional $284 million this year on Humvee armor kits to protect our troops from the roadside bombs. Now you got to weld a hook on the outside of it.
That's unbelievable.
All right. Some good news for all of you out there. This is from General Motors. This is something that General Motors is doing right. From now until the end of May, all active duty military and reserves, military retirees, and members of eligible military households can take advantage of a $1,000 private offer on select Buick, Pontiac, GMC, and Chevy models towards the purchase or lease of any most new and unused 2006-2007 cars. This offer may be combined with most current incentives and may be transferred to members of eligible military households. So get on down to your GM dealer and see what they can do for you. I think that's a great deal.
And yeah, it is. It's a very good deal.
I think that's about it for today on the news.
Oh, come on! You got to have more than that.
Well, How much do we want to get into?
You got another half a minute.
Oh, I got another half a minute.
Sure.
So well, all right. A story that I'm going to be starting to do more on is we're finding that a number of veterans, or not veterans, but active duty military personnel, are having severe reactions to some of the vaccines that they've been given to go to Iraq and Afghanistan. Mm. And in many cases, some people, there have been a number of deaths as a result of them, and severe reactions, kidney failures, and so on and so forth. And there is an ongoing investigation right now looking into whether it was one of those things where the troops were being given vaccines that they weren't aware of and that they were doing a little bit of testing on. So stay tuned for that story. That's coming from military.com.
And let's go into our Welcome Home segment.
We shall. Welcome Home. Each week on Veterans Radio, we welcome home servicemen and women who have been stationed around the world in the service of our country. Number one is that Secretary of Defense Robert Gates, as well as hundreds of families, friends, and members, welcomed home 200 troops on May 6th at the Dallas-Fort Worth International Airport. These troops were coming home for R&R, and I think this is great. This is an event that is sponsored by the Welcome Home a Hero program that is going on at the Dallas-Fort Worth Airport, and it looks like it's been instigated by the Vietnam Veterans of America Chapter 90 down there. Well done, guys. They do this to every plane that comes into Dallas-Fort Worth, welcoming home the troops for their R&Rs.
They have a great USO center at that airport.
It seems to me I remember going through there at one time.
Oh, it was great.
This is another example of this is a Vietnam Veteran of America chapter 983 greeted 104 sailors that were just passing through Rockford, Illinois on their way home and refueling their aircraft, and they had banners and so forth to welcome them home. The soldiers of the 175th Quartermaster Company were honored in a welcome home celebration that was held in Delaware, Ohio. And this was put on by each veteran coming back gets a Welcome Home Warrior Citizens Award. I think that's terrific. Welcome home.
And we're back on Veterans Radio. Ken Rogge with Dale Thronberry, and we're going to be talking today with a retired Air Force colonel by the name of Bud Day, George E. Day. Very, very decorated officer, an amazing man. I read his biography written by Robert Corum. And Robert Corum was supposed to be on the show, but he's out on a book tour. I wonder what book he's touting.
I can't imagine.
I can't imagine either. The book is called American Patriot, and it tells the story of Bud Day and his accomplishments. And And we have Bud Day on the phone. Good morning, Bud. Good morning, Bud. Bud, are you there?
Hello.
Hello, Bud. How are you?
Okay, I'm trying to get another phone going here.
Okay, we'll give you a minute to go get another phone.
Okay, can you give me a call back so I can answer on a different phone? This master station is right by the coffee pot, which is bubbling now.
Oh, okay.
Well, right back.
Pour me a cup. Okay, we'll call Bud back and get him on his other phone.
This is live radio, ladies and gentlemen.
Right.
Don't clear that. So take a quick opportunity here before we're going to do this at the end of the hour, but we'll do it at this time. We want to also say, you know, happy Mother's Day, of course, to all of our military moms and all of our real moms, because obviously without you, none of us would be here. And we want to congratulate especially the military moms for what you're doing for us and our country. And we wish you all well.
And the sacrifices
Hoo-ah!
That they make.
Yes.
There was a woman on the other TV the other day, she's in Kuwait. She's a lieutenant colonel, and she has three children back here in the States. And you see that, you just can't. Mm-hmm. Your heart goes out to them because it's so obviously painful to them to be separated from their families. And I think the mothers are more important to the kids than the fathers.
Probably.
Yeah, I mean,
begrudgingly, yes,
it's separation-wise. Separation-wise, I think it's more important for the mother to be there mm-hmm. than the father.
We've addressed that issue. I mean, we did a program, and for those of you that are interested, if you go back into our archives at veteransradio.net, there's a program where we talked to military moms last year at this time.
Uh-huh.
And I think that they'll find it very interesting to see how they feel.
Yeah,
about being in the dual jobs that they have between being a mom and being in the military.
Well, we had Christine Cook on too, who has had that experience, and
yes, and I talked with her last week, and she was saying that now that she's home, and seeing her children grow, she said, I can't believe I was gone for a whole year,
mm-hmm.
and unfortunately, as this thing goes on, it looks like that unit may be called up again in a little while, or another year or 6 months to go back again.
Wow.
So.
And they do recur. They keep going back. So, okay. I think Bud is back on the line. Bud, are you there?
I am here.
All right. That sounds better. How are you this morning?
Just fine. How are you doing?
Good. Welcome to Veterans Radio. We're so glad to have you on.
Thanks so much.
I just read, I don't know whether you heard, but I read the book by Robert Coram, American Patriot. And it so happens it's written about a guy by the name of Bud Day.
Yes.
Have you read the book?
Yes, I have.
I think it's a great book, and a lot of insight to who Bud Day is and his core values and so on. I think it's an amazing book. I want to ask you some things about your youth. You grew up in Iowa in pre-World War II days. What was it like back then?
Well, life was really pretty austere. We had the, I was born in 1925, and roughly late 1929, the banks failed. 1930, we had from the bank failure came the depression, and then the dust storm started in 1930, and we had almost a continual drought from 1930 roughly till 1937, varied in intensity, 30, 31, 32. 33 were the really, really bad years. Mm-hmm. Dry, drought, all of Arizona, New Mexico, southern Kansas was overhead in the air all the time.
Wow. And what was the patriotism like back then?
A very patriotic country, despite the hardships that were going on. People were really quite united, and the Franklin Roosevelt, when he got elected in 1932, had a message of optimism and hope, and he was an inspiring president in that he kept telling everybody things are going to get better, and he cranked up a lot of make-work projects like the PWA, which was the Public Works Administration, and the WPA, the Works Progress Administration, and They did flood control, blight, sewer systems, drainage, clean out for us, and put a lot of people to work at a remarkably low wage, like roughly $1.50 a day.
Wow. Just think about that today.
All right.
World War II began in 1941, and then you went in the military sometime after that. When did you go in?
I went in December of 1942. I was just 17 in February of 1942, so I would have gone in then if my parents would have permitted. But they continued to oppose me, and wasn't until December of that year that I was able to wear them down.
That's a good way of putting it. And you went into the Marine Corps.
Yes.
And you served where? Where did you go in the Marine Corps?
I served 30 months out in the Pacific. As soon as I got out of boot camp, I was sent out as a replacement and headed southwest. That's where all the action was.
You were on Johnston Island, I believe.
Yes, I was.
Yeah, so was I. But we had
no kidding.
We had a few years between us.
I'll be darned.
I was there in 1975 and 76.
Well, I'll be darned. Well, what happened was, you know, the 3rd Defense Battalion had been at Wake Island, and when they got overrun, they moved the 3rd Defense Battalion to Johnson.
Mm-hmm.
So we were maintaining Johnson, Midway, Palmyra, Christmas Island. We had forces on all of those places because at that time our intel was such a low quality that no one had a real clue where they were going to strike again. But those were all refueling stops and areas where you could recover airplanes, resupply, do that kind of stuff. And in fact, the Battle of Kwajalein, they launched a lot of airplanes out of Johnson Island to go strike Kwaj.
We're talking to Colonel Bud Day, one of America's most decorated officers, who holds all the combat medals available from the Medal of Honor on down, and we're pleased to have him with us this morning. Following the war, you returned to Iowa and got your bachelor's and law degrees, and then you joined the Iowa National Guard. Why?
Oh, I'd been a reservist. I joined the Army Reserve in 1946, and I knew we were going to war with Russia. It just, I had no question in my mind that communism was such a overarching evil, had a lot of aspirations about running the entire world. They thought that system was going to work, and of course they were having a lot of successes. It was working in China, was working in that occupied countries that they'd overtaken, the whole Iron Curtain front of countries. So they had some high hopes, and I was just positive that we were going to be in a shooting war with them. So that being the case, I felt that this time I was going to go as an officer, and I was going to stay ready.
And then you after you got into the Iowa Guard, you switched over to the Air Force.
Yes. The unit that I was attached to, the 185th Fighter Wing at Sioux City, got called up and went to Bangor, and I got called up just about the same time, so I went to pilot training.
Uh-huh. And then you stayed on active duty after that.
That's correct. Yeah. I had the good luck to be one of the very early jet pilots. I flew the F-80 and most of the succeeding fighters after that.
You've had several close calls in aircraft. In fact, to the best of my knowledge, you're the only person to bail out of a jet aircraft and survive without a parachute. What happened?
Oh, the airplane caught fire while I was giving a guy a standardization check to make sure he could do everything right. And so I was forced to try to land quickly, and things did not work out very well. The fire kept progressing up the aft end of the airplane, which I could not see. All I could tell was that some lights were on. And I tried to land that, and as I got close to the ground, the engine started coming apart, and stick locked up on me. I had no control of the elevator at all, and so I had to punch it about roughly 300 feet. And I was only doing about 170 knots, so the chute did not deploy, and I went ricocheting into a series of trees, and luckily just continued to top trees until my chute snagged up and slammed me to the ground.
Unbelievable.
It really was.
Yeah. Well, you had some other close calls. There was one about a T-33 and the aft door closing, and what was that one? Where they caught
fire? I had another fire on takeoff. For some reason or another, I had a propensity for fires. This was a defect in the airplane, the original F-80. The kind of a cap that it had on the fuel tank was not very sound. And when you pressurize the drop tanks on the airplane, it created a lot of very high pressure in the main fuel tank. And this cap lid was not very refined. It was sort of like screwing a lid on a fruit jar, except not quite that fancy or secure. And so that air pressure would force this cap to leak. And the leak was right in front of the engine. And the engine had a couple of doors on the top of the fuselage right behind the fuel tank. So when this stuff started to leak, it ran straight into the engine, lit the airplane up, and that was another miracle.
How did you put it out?
I had thought about that. Don Gentile, a big, great shooter back in World War II, had that same problem, and his response was to pull a nose up and try to land it. I thought that was the wrong idea, so I slammed the nose down, trying to get those doors closed, and they closed at about 120 knots plus. And so sure enough, that worked. I put it right down into the treetops and got the speed as quick as I could, and as soon as I got the 120 knots, the fire went out. I had a very ginger landing because I had a heavy airplane and didn't know exactly what was going to happen. And interestingly enough, when we pulled the airplane apart, the elevator cables were burned so bad you could snap them just with a jerk of the stick. That's what they did. They took the stick, gave it a jerk, and elevator cables failed.
I got to ask you, are you a cat?
That's what my wife asked me. Do you die on the ninth life or the tenth?
That's amazing. That you were able to survive all of those accidents. You had others too, didn't you?
Yes, I did.
Other incidents.
Yes, I did. I had the last one I had was quite interesting. I was strafing with a F-4. And we had a automatic target scoring system. It was a manufactured thing with a big plate on the bottom that caused it to sit flat. And it was like sort of like a big window. And as the bullets would go through this window, it would automatically score. But because they had to secure the thing and get it level some way, they had a huge steel plate that went across the bottom of it. Then they buried that and covered it with a huge amount of sandbags. And so I rolled in and fired, and what I didn't know was that they'd had a huge rainstorm between the last time we'd been to the range. These sandbags had gotten all shot up. The sand had leaked out. And when one of my bullets hit the steel plate, it ricocheted, and I took it right in the eye level in the bulletproof glass right in front of my eyes. I still have that windshield.
Do you really?
Yeah, they took it out and gave it to me. Had it not been for that bulletproof glass, I'd have taken my head right off.
Wow.
And if it had gone just 4 or 5 inches either direction to the side, that glass was not bulletproof. So had it come through there, it would have, hard to say what would happen. But one of the things about it showed I was perfectly lined up.
Mm-hmm.
I had an absolute 100% perfect alignment on a target.
Did you fly in Korea?
Mm-hmm.
What did you fly over there?
Flew the F-84.
As a bombing missions, or?
We were doing a lot of stuff. Primarily, we were doing, amazingly, with the 84, we were doing air defense. We were also doing tracking missions to divert the Russians up to the north and tie down a bunch of their air force. And these were missions where we'd take off, fly up to high altitude, point ourselves at some major port place in Russia, let down, and their radars would track us. And then we had some ELINT airplanes out there that would listen to the radio traffic and intercept the radar beams that were coming out of Russia and Manchuria. And so they would scramble airplanes to intercept us, and then we would continue, depending on what was going on, either right into the periphery of Russia or right up to the shores. So those were real fascinating missions because there were also several other kinds of airplanes doing the same thing at the same time, and we wound up keeping huge amount of the Russian Air Force out of Korea.
Mm-hmm.
And we sat nuclear alert there also, where we had some, at those days, small atomic bombs about the size of those that leveled Hiroshima. And so we were sitting alert in the event that Russians, you know, should really get berserk.
Uh-huh. Well, you had a full life before you went to Vietnam, so we want to pick up on Vietnam, and when we get back, we're going to take a short break here, and we're going to have a segment on that you might be interested in. It's called the Medal of Honor, and each week we highlight a Medal of Honor recipient and his accomplishments.
Oh, golly, great idea.
We're talking to Colonel Bud Day, America's living most decorated war hero. He holds every combat medal available. And we're going to be right back in just a few moments. You're listening to Veterans Radio.
The Medal of Honor is the highest award for valor in combat given a member of the Armed Forces of the United States. There have been over 3,400 recipients of the nation's highest award. This is one of them.
Torpedo Man Second Class Henry Brault closed a hatch on his sunken submarine, trapping him and a shipmate. Details after this. On the morning of 28 October 1923, the U.S. submarine O5 collided with a steamship and sank in less than a minute. When the collision occurred, Brault was in the torpedo room. Upon reaching the hatch, he saw that the boat was rapidly sinking. Instead of jumping overboard to save his own life, he returned to the torpedo room to the rescue of a shipmate whom he knew was trapped in the boat, closing the torpedo room hatch on himself. Brault and Brown remained trapped in this compartment until rescued by the salvage party 31 hours later. The Medal of Honor was presented by President Coolidge at the White House on 8 March 1924.
The Medal of Honor series is a production of Veterans Radio.
And we're back on Veterans Radio Talk. I think we've lost him. Let's get him back on the line. We've been talking with Colonel Bud Day, one of America's most decorated war heroes, who holds every combat medal available. Can you imagine that?
No. I'm just amazed. I want to know how many flying hours he had. I'd be interested in finding out what medals that he received during World War II.
None.
Just as a Marine.
I mean, he didn't receive any in World War II.
Because he was making up for lost time, I guess, at some point along the line.
Yeah, as a matter of fact, he didn't even get his good conduct medal. He was a little bit of a bad boy. Is he back on the line? Colonel Day, are you back?
I'm back.
All right, great. We lost you there for a minute.
Yeah, I think his phone went dead. I have picked up a different phone.
Oh, okay. All right. I hope, did you hear the whole Medal of Honor story?
I heard most of it.
Okay, good. Just a little side note. Your story was the second segment that we did when we started this show 3 years ago.
Doggone.
The first one that we did was just a kind of an introduction to what the Medal of Honor series was all about, and yours was the second one that we did. So
I'll be darned, huh?
We have Colonel Day back on the air, and we're talking with him about his experiences, and my cohort here, Dale Thronberry, has some questions for you, sir.
Okay.
Yes, sir. I flew helicopters in the Vietnam era, and I was just curious about how many flying hours do you have?
Hello?
Yep,
hello?
I'm still here.
Yeah, yep. Okay. I have about somewhere between 8,000 and 9,000 hours. At the time of that I got shot down, I had 4,800 hours of fighter, single-engine fighter time, and about a total of around 5,000 hours.
Wow, that's a lot of flying. No wonder you. Well, as a pilot, I know that almost all of us have lives like cats, and just learning about your stories, you haven't reached the end yet, which is good.
Right.
last year at this time, we had Don Shepard on our show talking about the Misties.
Yeah.
Tell us about the Misties.
Well, we cranked up in the spring of 1967 to try to replace the slow-flying 01 FACs that were flying up in North Vietnam. They'd moved the missiles down into central North Vietnam and wound up shooting down one of two 01s that were doing forward air control work up there. Forward air control work being finding targets, getting some fighters armed up with bombs and rockets and so forth, and shoot up the targets. So it became clear that the slow flyers could not continue because of the surface-to-air missile threat. So someone conceived the idea of flying a fast-back airplane. We picked the 100 for several reasons. It was available, was the best visibility, and longest legs. Put it to work and began, really, our major effort was a mixture between SAM suppression, surface killing the missiles, and trying to stop the flow of fuel, arms, and supplies down the Ho Chi Minh Trail. So we got into that with the vigor, and it started working out pretty well. Initially, we were not too sure about how well we were going to be able to find things in that jungle mess, but it got better as we got a little more experience.
You were shot down on August 26, 1967. What happened?
I was going in to take a look at a surface-to-air missile site. This would have been the furthermost south site that had ever been identified. It would have actually only been about 30 miles or so from the demilitarized zone. And I really thought in my heart of hearts that it was a flak trap. But we pumped on in there to take a look at it. I had a young kid from Iowa, Corin Kippenham, in the front seat. I was checking him out if he had we'd gotten through that ride okay. He was going to move up to the front seat. He was an 01 FAC, who one of several that we'd gotten to teach us how to do that. It turned out that the site, first time we flew over it, took a huge amount of ground fire, so it was either a flak trap or a good site. We went back over into Thailand, caught a tanker, pumped back up on gas, came back into North Vietnam across the corner, Cambodia and Laos, and as soon as we popped up over the karst, got about 4-5 miles from the target. They opened up on us again. Sun had moved. I could see the shadow of a missile. I could see the corner of a radar van this time. And just as we got almost over, straight over the target, we took a really bad hit in the aft section, shot the controls out, let the burner, got the nose up. We were doing about 540 or so, and as I got the nose up going through about 4,500 feet, the controls failed, and the airplane tried to do an outside loop. If you imagine looking at the moon and then going up and trying to circle back underneath the bottom of the moon, that was the kind of trajectory we were on. I couldn't control the airplane, so I told Kipper, punch it out, punched us out.
I busted my arm in three places, injured my left knee, and damaged my eye when my oxygen mask did not separate right. So when I hit the ground, I was busted up and injured and not in good shape to be captured. Young kid within just a minute or two showed up. I had gotten a call off to Airborne Triple ABC, who were the people that were aware of where we were a lot of the time. Told them I got shot down, told them I'd seen Kipper shoot. Well, that part was okay. And just about that time I got through talking, this kid popped through the brush with a real old Russian rifle, probably about 13 years old, and captured me.
You escaped a week later, and you spent 3 weeks in the jungles. We got recaptured, and then you spent 5.5 years as a guest of the NVA and the Hanoi Hilton.
Yes, sir.
Is it safe to say you didn't have room service?
That is safe to say.
How were you treated up there?
Well, it was really barbaric. Their theory was that we were criminals. The dingbat left here in this country were telling them that we were criminals. They were claiming this was a illegal, immoral war. The Vietnamese were echoing that. Fonda and Hayden and all of those anti-war types of the veterans against the war were telling some outrageous lying stories about what was going on with the communists and how we were being treated, and claimed that we were being treated well. So the bottom line was the food was just barely enough to keep you alive. You could plan on losing about a third of your body weight within about 3 months. There was basically close to zero medical care. The rooms were very tiny, filthy, and no effort to let you be clean, stay clean. The propagandized us roughly 12 hours a day. We heard from every nut dingbat that ever got on the radio back in those years against the war. Heard from a lot of people in different countries who were also telling us the war was illegal and immoral. And there was a lot of torture to get you to try to make radio releases, write to the president, write to Congress, back up these anti-war groups like Fonda and that group, Vietnam Veterans Against the War. They were perpetually trying to get us to do propaganda for them. So, and a lot of torture that went with that. Just by way of illustration, I was beat with a fan belt right after an escape from, I think it was July 6th to October 14th. I took initially about the first 2.5 days or so, I took over 300 strokes with the fan belt across my south end. And it just turned me into a bloody mess and had big holes in my knees from kneeling, and the back of my ankles were all cut from leg irons. And so when they got through with me, I was bleeding out both ends. Frankly, I'd hoped they would kill me because it was so awful that it was every day I went over there, it was just more of the same. So that was kind of typical of our treatment, and this was why we were so upset when John Kerry was over negotiating with the Vietnamese delegation in the 1970s, because it prolonged our imprisonment, caused several of our people to get killed, and caused the death of literally hundreds, maybe thousands of people on the battlefield.
That's terrible.
Yeah, the anti-war people's message was just hang in there. You know, Americans will wear out. If you just keep fighting, eventually the anti-war types will win the day. And as you know, finally Congress, particularly the Senate, cut the money off. And
well, Colonel, I got to cut you off. We have to take a short break, and we're going to come back, and we're going to talk a little bit more about your imprisonment and your after-imprisonment actions. You're listening to Veterans Radio. And we're back on Veterans Radio, talking with Colonel Bud Day, a Medal of Honor recipient, and our guest for the entire hour. Bud, throughout your imprisonment, you never cracked. You never gave the NVA any information. How did you hold out for that long?
Well, basically, when you get down to saying I never gave them any information, was bottom line is I never gave them any information of any value. The bottom line is that a determined torturer can make you say some stuff. You will hear some noises come out of your body when somebody tries to tear your arms off and saying that rope trick that you had no idea those noises were in you. Mm-hmm. So you get to the point where you begin to deal with them, basically have some kind of discussions with them, but the bottom line is on all the issues such as making propaganda for them or all of those things, that part you refuse to cooperate with. So I've refused to cooperate, and it cost me dearly. They wiped my arms out, and when I came out of jail, my hands and fingers were all rolled up, and had broken my arm. They'd hung me. They'd done that whipping that I told you about. So it was a high price to pay, but worthwhile.
You had a mantra that you had kept in your mind when you were in the camp. What was that?
It was return with honor.
And where did that come from?
It was the motto of the 31st Fighter Wing. It was also kind of a family thing. My wife's family were Norwegians. They were occupied by the Germans back during World War II. All of the men in the family, the young men, were either in a German prison camp or out in the woods, in the underground, in the resistance movement where they were sabotaging and doing destructive stuff with the German supply lines and roads and so on, and eventually the heavy water project. And so the bottom line was that I had to perform certainly as well as they did. I had also been a little bit involved with the code of conduct that had come out of Korea, and there was a lot of criticism about performance of prisoners in Korea, which much of it was unjustified. Although I didn't know that at the time that I went off to Vietnam, because that issue had never been really cleared up.
Mm-hmm.
And there were supposedly some things that had happened in Korea that were just unacceptable, and I made up my mind I wasn't going to be a part of that. And if I had a command, nothing like that was going to happen in my command, and whatever the case was, I was going to come out of there with my head up or I was not going to come back.
Mm-hmm. The POWs held regular worship services in the camp. How did the NVA react?
They were really upset about that because, in the communist system, when the communist cadre got up to talk, everybody listened and everybody did something. So they instantly assumed that because we had someone standing up in front of the group and talking, preaching, that we must be trying to crank up some kind of a revolt, escape, something. And so they were really opposed to that. And we told them it was just going to be a church service, but they don't know what church services are.
Mm-hmm.
Because there is no church in a communist country. So despite the fact, that they issue those platitudes about treating people well and so on, they had no religious background at all, so when we started having the church service, they got really upset and told us that had to stop and we're going to have to do a lot of different things, and we had a different idea about what was going to happen, and so we cranked up the church service, and they busted in the doors and grabbed Robbie Reisner, who was the preacher, and the people who were in the choir, and started them out of the room, and I got up in the center of a concrete thing and started singing the Star-Spangled Banner. And this just really triggered them off, and all the other rooms picked it up. At that time, there were about 350 prisoners in the downtown Hanoi Hilton complex. So every room started picking us up. Every room started singing with us. And so we sang the Star Spangled Banner, God Bless America, My Country, Tis of Thee, California Here, Isa, Texas, you name it. We gave all.
Very quickly, tell us the story about the flag.
Yes. One of my people manufactured a guy, really great young Navy lieutenant commander named Mike Christian from Alabama, had stolen some little piece of semi-red cloth, and he gotten some pieces of semi-white thread out of a blanket. Another guy manufactured a nail out of a piece of wire, and Mike made this flag. So he sewed it inside of his little kind of a T-shirt. They were sort of a heavy cloth thing. He sewed it inside the sleeve of his jacket, and every day when the guards were sleeping in the afternoon, they'd take a nap after they ate. We would get that flag out, put it up in the center of the room, face to the west, and say the Pledge of Allegiance to the United States. It was a very uplifting thing, one of those ways that sounds kind of not so big a deal when I'm talking about it on this phone, but it was a very important morale issue.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted every day to make sure that everybody understood that we were still Americans, so we were still connected at the umbilical cord with our country. And wasn't any better way of doing that than to say the Pledge of Allegiance or sing the Star Spangled Banner. So we did that, and as a result of that, one day on a room inspection, the V found that flag. So they took Mike out and just broke him up. They just really pounded him up. He came back, and he was all dinged up, and I think he had a busted rib and several big bruises on his face and a lot of black and blue marks. And so we still had the needle. And that night, after he was gone for about 16 hours, they took him out in the afternoon. We didn't get him back till late the next day. And so that night, he was down in the end of the room. And I looked down there, and here he is. He's got another rag and a piece of white thread, and he's sewn another flag.
Wow. That's amazing.
What
was the Fink release program?
We had I think it was a total of 12 prisoners who got released early. It started in February of 1968. Three guys got released. They were all people who had never been tortured, who had no visible bone breaks, anything like that. People who had not lost a lot of weight yet. Also, it involved some people who didn't have 100% personal conviction. And so the Vietnamese started kind of dangling this release, and the idea from their standpoint was it could not violate the code of conduct because they were just putting them out of the country. And so that's a compelling argument if you are not too motivated to do what you're supposed to do. So they got three guys to go home, and Jim Stockdale, who was the ranking Navy guy over in the Hilton, called that the Fink release.
Mm-hmm.
Fink obviously has its obvious meaning. You're not much of a, not a very good human. And so that started, and then it continued. The first group of people went out, didn't really say anything anti-American. But the second group did, and they started talking about the war being illegal and immoral and so on, and as a result, got released early. So that confirmed what Stockdale had commented calling it the Fink release, because they're obviously, you were doing something to get out of there that nobody else was doing. You know, if I'm getting tortured to make tapes or do something, write to prison or whatever it is, and somebody goes home saying the Vietnamese are treating us well, one of us has got to be lying. So the guy who went home early and claimed that he'd been treated well obviously was lying, and he'd done something. He'd sold a little piece of his soul to get out of there. So that was a bad program, and unfortunately had 12 guys who got involved in that. Then we had about three or four pretty senior guys of Marine Navy commander and Navy lieutenant commander and another guy who were actually doing propaganda for the Gooks.
Colonel, we've got just about a minute left, so I want to quickly go into your actions after you retired. You took on another battle, and that was the health care for life for military retirees.
Yes, the Clinton administration kicked the World War II Korean retired military veterans out of the hospital at age 65. They had promised us as part of our enlistment contract, free lifetime medical care for ourselves and our family along with our pension. So they just retracted a huge amount of our military benefits. I sued them. Janet Reno was the attorney general. So I sued her and pursued that to a victory in the Federal Circuit Court of Appeals. We had a bill in the House and Senate. John McCain sponsored our bill in the Senate.
Who is your very, very good friend.
Yes, and Ronnie Shouse from Mississippi sponsored the House bill. We got it passed before I got the actual order out of the Federal Circuit Court of Appeals where I'd won that case. And so it's called TRICARE for Life and restored really about 95% of those benefits that the administration took away from us.
Thank you very much, Colonel. We have to get out of here. I want to thank you for being on Veterans Radio. As you've got a fascinating life, and we wish you many, many years ahead.
God bless you all, and keep doing what you're doing.
Thank you, sir.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Colonel Bud Day, America's most decorated living war hero, holds every medal from the Medal of Honor on down. This, we got to go. You're on Veterans Radio. Goodbye. We'll be right back.